Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 558, titled The Eichmann File. This has been recorded on June 11th of the year 2006. This program is going to deal with, or does deal with, Adolf Eichmann, who was the man in charge of the actual liquidation of European Jewry under the Third Reich. This past week, a number of previously clandestine files were declassified and made available to the public, and these files concerned the use of Nazis by U.S. intelligence after World War II, something that is very well known to regular listeners to this program. The dominant element of that phenomenon, of course, being the Reinhard Gehlen spy outfit. Reinhard Gehlen, Major General for the Third Reich, was brought into the U.S. 3 months after VE Day, and his entire organization, including numerous SS and Gestapo officers, was set up as the CIA's Department of Russian and Eastern European Affairs. It then became the de facto NATO intelligence organization, and ultimately became the BND, the West German Intelligence Service, while still basically providing the U.S. and NATO with most of its intelligence, or quote intelligence, unquote, about the Soviet bloc. This past week, it emerged that the CIA knew where Adolf Eichmann was hiding in 1958. He was in Argentina, along with a great many other Third Reich emigre, and yet the CIA did not tell the Israelis. Information about this in the New York Times of Wednesday, June 7th of 2006, an article by Scott Chain, Dateline Washington, headline, CIA knew where Eichmann was hiding, documents show. It reads in part, the Central Intelligence Agency took no action after learning the pseudonym and whereabouts of the fugitive Holocaust Administrator Adolf Eichmann in 1958, according to CIA documents released Tuesday that shed new light on the spy agency's use of former Nazis as informants after World War II. Skipping down. The Eichmann papers are among 27,000 newly declassified pages released by the CIA to the National Archives under congressional pressure to make public files about former officials of Hitler's regime later used as American agents. The material reinforces the view that most former Nazis gave American intelligence little of value and in some cases proved to be damaging double agents for the Soviet KGB, according to historians and members of the government panel that has worked to open the long secret files. We'll comment about this a little later. Elizabeth Holtzman, a former congresswoman from New York and member of the panel, the Nazi War Crimes and Japanese Imperial Government Records Interagency Working Group, said the documents showed that the CIA, quote, failed to lift a finger, unquote, to hunt Eichmann and, quote, force us to confront not only the moral harm but the practical harm, unquote, of relying on intelligence from ex-Nazis. The United States government, preoccupied with the Cold War, had no policy at the time of pursuing Nazi war criminals. The records also show that American intelligence officials protected many former Nazis for their perceived value in combating the Soviet threat. But Ms. Holtzman, speaking at a news briefing at the National Archives on Tuesday, said information from the former Nazis was often tainted both by their personal agendas, unquote, and their vulnerability to blackmail, quote. Using bad people can have very bad consequences, unquote, Ms. Holtzman said. She and other group members suggested that the findings should be a cautionary tale for intelligence agencies today. As head of the Gestapo's Jewish Affairs Office during the war, Eichmann put into effect the policy of extermination of European Jewry, promoting the use of gas chambers and having a hand in the murder of millions of Jews. Captured by the United States Army at the end of the war, he gave a false name and went unrecognized, hiding in Germany and Italy before fleeing to Argentina in 1950. Israeli agents hunting for Eichmann came to suspect that he was in Argentina but did not know his alias. They temporarily abandoned their search around the time in March 1958 that West German intelligence told the CIA that Eichmann had been living in Argentina as Clemens, said Mr. Naftali of the University of Virginia. The West German government was wary of exposing Eichmann because officials feared that he might reveal, feared what he might reveal about such figures as Hans Globke, a former Nazi government official then serving as a top national security advisor to Chancellor Konrad Adenauer, Mr. Naftali said. In 1960, also at the request of West Germany, the CIA persuaded Life magazine, which had purchased Eichmann's memoir from his family, to delete a reference to Mr. Globke before publication, the documents show. And then the article goes on to talk about the numerous Soviet double agents, including Heinz Felpe, perhaps the most notorious of those. There are many things that are not discussed here, including the fact that many of those double agents were in all probability triple agents as well. They may very well have actually been working for the underground Reich while ostensibly working for the Soviets and at a more superficial level for the West. Another thing that is not discussed here is the fact that although the best people in Germany, and there are many of those, are vehemently anti-fascist and anti-Nazi, far more so than the average American, I would add, that the power institutions, to coin a term in Germany, were never denazified. The German core corporations, the military, the intelligence service, the top political leadership, and the police remain under the control of a Third Reich that went underground. It's also not to say that there aren't some sincere anti-fascists within those institutions. As I talked about in For the Record program 336, the case of Sylvan Becker, a man who might be termed the German John O'Neill, exemplifies the divisions within German power structure as well. So I don't want to have my comments here oversimplified. But the fact of the matter is that basically, after waving the ostensible magic wand and saying, okay, no more Nazis, they were put right back in power. Konrad Adenauer's top aide, basically his gray eminence, viewed by many as the real power in the federal government, the government of the Federal Republic of Germany, was Hans Globke, who drew up the Law for the Protection of German Blood and Honor. That was the law under which the extermination of the Jews took place. And Adenauer, although not a member of the Nazi Party, was an intimate of the Nazi Party, succeeded as chancellor by Ludwig Erhard, who was a member of the Kleine Arbeitskreis, a joint SS industrialist working group. He, in turn, was succeeded by Kurt Kiesinger, who was in charge of radio propaganda for Goebbels' propaganda ministry. AFA program number 2 and AFA program number 37 go into this. One of the things that is so interesting about the disclosures concerning Eichmann is that, according to author Glenn Infield in a text called Skorzeny Hitler's Commando, which we're going to excerpt in a minute, Adolf Eichmann had actually worked under contract for the CIA in the Middle East, helping to put together the Egyptian intelligence service and general staff for Mr. Naguib and the power behind the throne, Gamal Abdel Nasser. The passage that we're going to read also exemplifies many of the elements of confusion within the intelligence community and the national security establishment. Although many elements of the U.S. national security establishment, as is the case, was the case, and is the case in Germany, are definitely anti-Nazi and anti-fascist, other elements were working with a different agenda, this has often led to confusion. Now, turning to get to Skorzeny Hitler's Commando by Glenn Infield, this book, by the way, published in hardcover by St. Martin's Press, in 1952, a group called the Young Officers seized control from King Farouk in Egypt. Mr. Naguib was the nominal head of the government, but actually General Nasser, who became the formal head of the government, was the real power behind the throne. He turned to the CIA under Alan Dulles, who had numerous Nazi connections, having advised many, including the Bush family, on their Nazi investments and then maneuvered those Nazi investments. Dulles then was inextricably linked with not only incorporating many Nazi and SS elements into the intelligence community of this country, but actually importing entire SS intelligence units into the country, where those and other fascist collaborators evolved into a branch of the Republican Party. Alan Dulles, as head of the CIA, didn't want to lose this potential foot into Egyptian society. On the other hand, he didn't want to alienate Israel by allocating formal CIA officers to the job of aiding Nasser, Israel's enemy. So in typical sort of CIA realpolitik, they screwed things up even worse by turning to Otto Skorzeny. Now, Otto Skorzeny was Hitler's commando chief, one of Hitler's personal favorites, a formal military individual. He was in charge of all commando training for the Third Reich. And as we looked at in AFA program number 22 and in FTR 364, he pioneered the use of suicide weapons for the Third Reich and the Axis. More about that later. Skorzeny became the chief functional element of the Odessa, the post-war Nazi SS underground, and many elements of that, in turn, worked with, or ostensibly with, the CIA and other elements of Western intelligence. Dulles turned to Skorzeny to recruit people to put together the Egyptian intelligence service and general staff, and that's where we're going to pick up Glenn Infield's narrative. The takeover of the country by Naguib, with Nasser playing the role of a shadowy dictator in the background, opened the door wide for the three silent conspirators of Hitler's regime, Galen, Schacht, and Skorzeny. By the way, Galen is the aforementioned Reinhard Galen. Hjalmar Horace Greeley Schacht was the finance minister for the Third Reich and an intimate of many of the Wall Street heavy hitters. Continuing. As Galen stated in his memoirs, quote, "We found Arab countries particularly willing to embrace Germans with an ostensibly Nazi past," unquote. And Naguib was quick to ask for help. Since his revolt had the backing of the CIA and he was aware that Galen was collaborating with the U.S. intelligence agency, his request for someone to train his security forces went to Pulak, Galen's headquarters south of Munich. Galen and Schacht were in complete agreement that the man for the job was Otto Skorzeny. Dulles, aware of Skorzeny's anti-Soviet role during the immediate post-war years when the Western nations desperately needed help, concurred. Skorzeny went to Egypt as Naguib's military advisor. It was a decision the United States would regret in later years. There was, of course, another reason former Nazis were quick to accept the Egyptian invitation. It once again pitted them against the Jews in the newly established Israeli nation. As the Yiddish Rundschau stated in 1951, quote, "As for Skorzeny's anti-Semitic and fascist propensities, this is undoubtedly true. Skorzeny readily admits his strong anti-Semitism," unquote. Galen, too, had reservations about the relationship between the new West German government and Israel. Quote, "I have always regarded it as something of a tragedy that West Germany was inevitably dragged into an alliance with the State of Israel against the Arab countries," he stated in his memoirs. "I always regarded their, Arabs' traditional friendship for Germany as of immense value for our national reconstruction. And at the request of Alan Dulles and the CIA, we at Pulak did our best to inject life and expertise into the Egyptian Secret Service, supplying them with the former SS officers I have mentioned," unquote. If there was any doubt that Naguib was pro-German, his public statements cleared up the misunderstanding. Quote, "I want you to believe me when I say that I have not changed the great admiration I have for the Germans. Their efficiency, their extraordinary gifts as scientists and technicians, and their loyalty are quite unique. I have been noticing all these qualities in recent times, watching the work of the German officers and experts in my army," unquote. Dr. Nuruddin Taraf, one of Naguib's most important supporters and later Minister of Health, was even more explicit when speaking of the Germans, particularly the Nazis. Quote, "Hitler is the man of my life. The German dictator had been an ideal leader who dedicated his life to the realization of his noble ambition. He never lived for himself, but for Germany and the German people. I have always wished to live like him," unquote. Skorzeny felt at ease among Egyptian officials with this attitude. His first task was to organize a staff of former SS and Wehrmacht officers to train the Egyptian army and security forces. Now remember, this is being done on contract for the CIA and Alan Dulles. Continuing. He, Skorzeny, selected carefully, making certain that each officer he brought to Egypt was a diehard Nazi, an expert military tactician, and was anti-Semitic. Among those recruited by Skorzeny was SS General Oskar Dulewanger, who had commanded a brigade composed of poachers, criminals, and men under the sentence of court-martial during the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, and whose actions against the Jews had earned him the nickname Butcher of Warsaw, unquote. SS Colonel Adolf Eichmann, the officer Himmler charged with the destruction of millions of Jews and who later would be kidnapped from Argentina by the Israeli Secret Service and smuggled back to Israel to stand trial. SS General Wilhelm Farnbacher, Panzer General Oskar Munzel, Leopold Gleim, former chief of Hitler's personal guard, and Gestapo security chief of German-occupied Poland, and Joachim Daimling, former chief of the Gestapo in Dusseldorf. To handle medical problems, Skorzeny recruited Dr. Hans Eisele, who had been chief medical officer at Buchenwald concentration camp, and Heinrich Wiedermann, former medical director at Dachau. U.S. officials, many of them unaware that Alan Dulles had encouraged Galen to provide Naguib with German military advisors, became worried when so many infamous Nazi officers appeared in Egypt. Even Dulles became concerned when it was reported to him that Skorzeny was meeting often with Gamal Abdel Nasser, the Egyptian army lieutenant colonel who seemed to be giving more orders than Naguib. A secret letter, Embassy Dispatch 2276 from Jefferson Caffrey of the U.S. Embassy in Cairo to the Department of State in Washington, indicates that inquiries concerning Skorzeny's activities in Egypt were being conducted. The following is from For the Record Program number 180. It, in turn, is from RFA Program number 37, and the article excerpted here is The Secret Treaty of Fort Hunt, by author Carl Oglesby. That is from Covert Action Information Bulletin, issue number 35. And from that program and from that article, we get the following. We're going to go back to Radio Free America program number 37, and specifically we're going to take a look at the fourth week in that 13-part series. This is from August 16th of 1992, and in turn you're going to hear an article by Carl Oglesby entitled The Secret Treaty of Fort Hunt. This from Covert Action Information Bulletin, issue number 35. And again, this is RFA 37 from August 16th of 1992. The article by Carl Oglesby, The Secret Treaty of Fort Hunt. Indeed, a partly declassified CIA document recapitulated this story in the early 1970s, noting that at this time, quote, Galen met with Admiral Karl Dönitz, D-O-E-N-I-T-Z, who had been appointed by Hitler as his successor during the last days of the Third Reich. Galen and the Admiral were now in a U.S. Army VIP prison camp in Wiesbaden. Galen sought and received approval from Dönitz to, unquote. And Oglesby goes on to comment, in other words, the German chain of command was still in effect, and it approved of what Galen was doing with the Americans. And in a footnote, he goes on to add, that is, Oglesby goes on to add, as Galen was about to leave for the United States, he left a message for Hermann Bonn, that was one of his aides, with another of his top aides, Gerhard Wessel, W-E-S-S-E-L. I would note that Gerhard Wessel ultimately became head of the BND after Galen resigned. Quote, I am to tell you from Galen that he has discussed with Hitler's successor, Admiral Karl Dönitz, and Galen's superior and chief of staff, General Franz Halder, H-A-L-D-E-R, the question of continuing his work with the Americans. Both were in agreement, unquote. So, in addition to Karl Dönitz, Hitler's successor, Galen's chief of staff and superior, General Franz Halder, also approved of what Galen was doing. And again, the importance of this couldn't be exaggerated. And as Oglesby comments quite rightly, in other words, the German chain of command was still in effect, and it approved of what Galen was doing with the Americans. I don't doubt that one bit. That again from For the Record 180 and RFA 37 from August 16th of 1992. Now, in addition to Adolf Eichmann, who at least in one instance is alleged to have worked on contract for the CIA, Eichmann's superior in the Jewish desk, so to speak, at the SS, Otto von Bolschwing, also went to work for U.S. intelligence and was brought into the United States. Beyond that, his protege, Helena von Thom, drew up the list from which all of Ronald Reagan's cabinet appointments were made. The following is from AFA program number 30, recorded on June 28th of 1987. We also covered this information in AFA program number 3 from June of 1984. In addition to my own voice, you will also hear the voice of my very charming and capable former co-host, Nip Tuck, who assisted me with the on-air responsibilities. Reading now from the San Jose Mercury of November 20th of 1981.
This is an article also by Pete Carey, the same fellow who wrote that other article, the one that just read you, and it's headlined, Ex-Nazi's Brilliant U.S. Career Strangled in a Web of Lies. For the past 10 years, Otto Albrecht Alfred von Bolschwing's carefully constructed life in America has been coming apart a piece at a time. He was president of a high-technology investment firm with headquarters in Sacramento Valley and subsidiaries in the Silicon Valley. It went bankrupt in a 1971 scandal. He was a doting husband until his ailing wife killed herself in 1978. He numbered among his business associates bankers and scientists. He numbered among his business associates millionaires, bankers, and scientists. He told friends he had worked for the Americans during and after World War II. But in May, the federal government began proceedings to deport him for lying about his Nazi past. In a widely publicized attempt to revoke von Bolschwing's citizenship, the Justice Department accused him of helping Hitler's persecution of European Jews and of being an associate of Adolf Eichmann, the architect of Germany's mass killing program. The disclosures come at the end of a long, improbable career that took von Bolschwing through the Nazi hierarchy, into the CIA, and finally to the highest levels of American business. As a businessman, von Bolschwing was vague about the war years. He said he had been a Gestapo prisoner and had worked for the CIA in post-war Germany. In 1969, he was asked about his German past during a job interview with Trans International Computer Investment Corporation, a high-flying investment firm that had founded several companies in the Silicon Valley. Von Bolschwing told his interviewer that he had been a lawyer. Skipping down in the article, who was this ex-Nazi and how did he prosper in America? Von Bolschwing's attorney would not allow an interview. This account was developed from people who knew him, accounts of Nazi Germany, court records, and business files. Born October 15, 1909, to East Prussian nobility, the family estate was founded in 1302, von Bolschwing attended school in Breslau and became a Nazi Party member at the age of 24, the only member of his family to do so. He joined the SS, the elite secret police of the Nazis, 6 years later. According to the Justice Department, as an SS captain, he helped plan the exclusion of Jews from the German economy and developed anti-Jewish propaganda to force their emigration from Germany. In a history of the SS by Heinz Hirne, von Bolschwing is described as, quote, a party member, an SD, foreign intelligence informer, and an experienced salesman in the motor trade, unquote. In 1938, again quoting Hirne, he was in contact with a group of Palestinian Germans who lined their pockets by certain extramural intelligence activities, according to Hirne, who wrote that von Bolschwing spied on the Zionist Haganah Army. Ejected from Palestine by the British for espionage, he surfaced in Romania as a government oil expert, unquote. By his own account, in 1941, he helped the leadership of the Iron Guard, a right-wing movement, escape to Berlin after it had gone on a three-day rampage in which many Jews, the estimates vary considerably, brutally were killed. The same year, he became a partner in the Amsterdam Bank, the Bank Boer Onirande Zaken. Investigators said they suspect the bank may have played a role in the Aryanization, the forced sale, of Dutch Jewish farms, businesses, homes, and securities. In August of 1941, von Bolschwing was tossed into a Gestapo prison with no formal charges, and in April 42, he was just as mysteriously released. In 1945, he helped American troops entering Austria catch Nazi officials and SS officers, according to a letter written for von Bolschwing by a colonel in the 71st U.S. Infantry. The war over, von Bolschwing made a move crucial to his future success. He became an American spy. Quote, he knocked on the door of U.S. Army intelligence, a source explained, and said, I'm experienced, I have a ring operating. If you give me a paycheck, I'll make you very happy. He was sort of a miniature Reinhard Galen. Galen was the Nazi general who helped the CIA build a spy network in post-war Eastern Europe, then became head of post-war German intelligence activities. According to one unconfirmed report, von Bolschwing became the controller of Galen's CIA operation after Galen returned to German government. He must have done something right, the source said. In December of 1953, von Bolschwing applied to immigrate to the United States, and on February 2, 1954, he arrived in this country. After obtaining several menial jobs, he became a citizen in 1959 when his career took a sudden upward turn. He became an assistant to the director of international marketing at Warner Lambert Pharmaceutical Company, developing close ties to the company's president, the late Elmer Bobbs, and its honorary board chairman, former New Jersey Governor Alfred Driscoll, according to a close associate. His contacts at Warner Lambert were way out of proportion with his job, the associate said. Driscoll continued to write him recommendations for many years. This is the most important single part of the article here. In March of 1969, von Bolschwing got a job in high technology. He was retained as an international business consultant by TCI, the Sacramento firm. The company planned to commercialize on technology developed in the Silicon Valley and used a few years earlier to monitor troop movements in the 1967 Arab-Israeli War, according to the firm's founder, Oswald S. Williams. TCI's subsidiaries in Palo Alto and Mountain View, Advanced Information Systems and International Imaging Systems, recall that's the company Hakim purchased, were developing a high-volume computer network for business and a navigation system for oil tankers using satellite communications, Williams said. Skipping down into the article, TCI's high-powered directors, one was J. Paul Getty Jr., son of the oil billionaire, thought enough of von Bolschwing to make him the firm's president in 1970. He seemed like a very polite and cultured person, said Walter F. Leverton, former vice president for satellite systems of the Aerospace Corporation. Leverton sat on the board of TCI. Skipping down, records and interviews with TCI officials indicate that Helena von Damm, President Reagan's Austrian-born deputy assistant, translated some German contracts for TCI and invested $1,000 in it while she was then Governor Reagan's secretary in Sacramento. Von Damm was too busy, unquote, to talk about von Bolschwing, but through her White House secretary, she said she knew him socially, unquote, in Sacramento many years ago. So the important parts of this is to remember von Bolschwing's role as quite possibly the head of Galen's North American operation. Of course, we've looked at the Galen organization many, many times. And also, in particular, to remember the fact that International Imaging Systems was one of TCI's subsidiaries, one of TCI's employees, and a social contact of von Bolschwing was Helena von Damm. Niptuck's going to read you about Helena von Damm, and then we'll come back and we'll talk a little more about some of the significance of some of these connections, because this may appear to some people to be a little bit off the track. We're going to tie that back in here in just a sec.
This is from the San Francisco Chronicle for Tuesday, August 3rd, 1982. The headline is Big Promotion for Reagan's Ex-Secretary, and it goes like this. President Reagan announced yesterday in Des Moines that he will promote Helena von Damm to the position of Assistant to the President for Presidential Personnel. She will replace E. Pendleton James, who is returning to the private sector, according to the White House announcement. Von Damm, formerly Reagan's secretary, has worked with him since his first campaign for governor of California in 1966. She is now deputy assistant to the president and director of presidential personnel. The president also announced that he will nominate Edward A. Curran, 48, until recently an official in the Education Department, to be deputy director of the Peace Corps. So, August 82, Helena von Damm gets her big promotion, becomes the head of presidential personnel, assistant to the president for presidential personnel. Again, I think we erroneously first read this at one point as being his personal secretary, but in fact she was the person who put together the list of people to be promoted according to out of the White House. A very significant list and a very significant duty for a woman who had been, is connected into this case in some other interesting ways.
That again from AFA program number 30, recorded on June 28th of 1987. Note again that Eichmann's superior was actually brought into the United States under the auspices of the Crusade for Freedom and Alan Dulles. Note also that his protege, Helena von Damm, drew up the list from which all of Ronald Reagan's cabinet appointments were made. And occasionally, a few of those appointments actually showed some of what was going on underneath. Note that U.S. officials, many of them anyway, didn't really know what they were doing when they were dealing with Galen. The German general staff chain of command was still in effect when Galen worked for CIA. When Pat Buchanan resigned as press secretary for the Reagan White House, the man selected to replace him, a gentleman named Kohler, in turn had to resign when it turned out he'd been in the Hitler Youth, sort of revealing what was going on beneath the scenes. This concludes For the Record program number 558, the Eichmann file, being recorded on June 11th of 2006. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.